Hi, and welcome back to the Mindful Sport Performance Podcast. I'm Dr. Keith Kaufman.
I'm Dr. Tim Pino.
And we are very excited to be joined today by Samantha Livingstone. Samantha is an Olympic gold medalist in swimming. She's a high performance consultant. She's a speaker and a mental health advocate, so she wears a lot of hats. In 2016, Samantha founded Livingstone High Performance and the Whole Athlete Initiative in response to the mental health crisis impacting adolescents across the globe. Livingstone High Performance provides pillars of support to organizations, teams, and individuals to elevate mental health and improve performance. Samantha also holds a master's in education and is a certified instructor of mental health first aid and a facilitator of mindful sport performance enhancement. She's a graduate of our MSPE instructor program. And Samantha and her husband, Rob, live in New England with their four daughters. To learn more about Samantha and her practice, her work, you can visit her website at www.samanthalivingstone.com. And that's SamanthaLivingstone.com. So thank you so much, Samantha, for being with us today. We are very excited to talk with you.
I'm so excited to reconnect with you both and to be here, and I'm honored to be part of this podcast and this conversation. So thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, we are honored to have you on. As I mentioned, you went through our instructor training program, and so we got to know you a little bit there and hear a bit about all the interesting work that you're doing. But obviously your background as an athlete and now in mental health and the work that you're doing and bringing mindfulness into that work, I think there's a lot of interesting ground to cover today in talking about your journey and how you're doing this now. So
yes, I'm excited to talk about it. You have to keep me on track.
Yeah, right. It just feels like there are so many things I want to ask you about. Though first, we do like to start our episodes with a brief meditation. You have very graciously accepted our invitation to lead one for us. Perhaps now we can kind of kick it to you to lead us through a brief meditation.
Awesome. And thank you.
Our quick standard disclaimer too, that please make sure you do this in a safe way. If Samantha asks you to close your eyes, don't do that while you're driving or doing anything that could be risky or dangerous. So
yes, thank you for that. So this was trying to choose was an interesting, we could talk about that for the rest of this space. This meditation is called Being Present. So as we begin, start to settle into the meditation. You can allow your eyes to close if that feels all right for you. You can also keep a soft gaze on the floor if that feels better. When you feel ready to begin, you can start to notice what is happening in the present moment. You might become aware of body sensations, sounds, smells, taste, or sight even with the eyes closed. Allow yourself to observe your present time experience without controlling or changing it. If you notice that you are lost in thinking, see if you can come back to the present moment. Return to what is happening at your sense doors. You might notice the different sounds in this room, the temperature of the air on your skin, the smell of your own shampoo. Allow your awareness to gently drift from one sense to another. If your mind wanders, gently bring it back to your sense doors. When you feel ready, you can start to notice the feeling of your feet on the floor. you can come back to a grounded sense of presence. Then slowly, you can allow your eyes to open.
Thank you so much. That was really nice.
Yeah, I'm curious, how did you choose that one?
That was my exact question.
Yeah, so I think, well, I love, the question of choosing, I love the diaphragmatic breathing exercise. That is one of my go-tos that's in your MSP ebook. And I chose this one, so I was tossing between the two. And this one, because I think that sometimes it's so hard to just, we get caught up in running through our day and doing and doing and doing and doing, even if we're in this great pause that is the pandemic, it's still this busyness to us. And so I think part of my work is in helping to bridge to the space of meditation and mindfulness, right? In meditation and in this practice of, that seems so distant and far away in the athletic arena at times. And so by being present and noticing and pausing to be in the present moment, I don't know that we're taught that, how to pause and be still and notice the physical sensations, the thoughts that are in our mind. And so this for me is on the shorter side, was one of the reasons, because a lot of the ones I love are body scans and they're longer, but just this 1 minute, 1.5 minutes, that is a practice that can grow that mindfulness muscle. So I know that's a long-winded answer to your question.
That's a great answer.
So.
Yeah, I know, I really like that. I mean, because it's certainly something that we try to emphasize all the time, right? But like figuring out a way to give yourself that daily dose of practice, and mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be like, well, I gotta sit for 30 minutes on my meditation cushion. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, you can just breathe for a minute.
And that being able to infuse that. So I meditate every morning. That's part of my morning routine. And that is wonderful and grounding. And I also have learned that if I don't build in these moments of pause, then I get swept in the day and it's like resetting again in the morning. And so being able to pause and be present in the experience, no matter what part of the day you're in, is really powerful. And it helps to grow that responding muscle. So, yeah.
I mean, that was exactly my reaction to the practice. So I also meditate every morning and meditated this morning. And since then, it's pretty much been nonstop in my day. And so it felt so nice to pause. And even though, as you said, it was so brief, it felt like such a warm, welcome experience to just slow down and listen to your voice and tune into parts of my experience. I really enjoyed that very much.
I think
it's always striking how when we talk about mindfulness, is not something that you pull out just when you need it. It's a way of being, but how when you do make the choice to slow down, sometimes you recognize, wow, I was moving really fast.
Yes.
You know, just the contrast, even, you know, as we were just starting this, I wouldn't have thought, wow, I was moving fast, but just taking that minute and a half, it really highlights that difference.
Mm-hmm. And that ability to pause and move towards something instead of this all or nothing, what you were mentioning, Tim, like this longer meditation, like that was one of my big blocks to practicing, was that I was stuck in that all or nothing mindset. And so, so yes, it's the daily, it's pausing.
And I really liked, I like the emphasis on smell. Oftentimes, especially in a brief meditation, it's about like feeling your breath, which I think is an important part of meditation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but I think sound and smell are such powerful senses that when we really start to quiet our mind, we recognize like there are so many scents and so many sounds in our environment that we just weren't paying attention to. Mm-hmm. And so it's like this way that like even just slowing down for a minute, kind of like focusing on something like smell, like highlights like, oh, I was missing so much. Like I wasn't just moving fast, but like that was having an impact and I was missing things.
Mm-hmm.
I just really like that.
Thank you.
And I wanted to ask, one of the big questions we wanted to spend a few minutes with you on is you obviously have this very rich history as an Olympic athlete and have made your way over into, we'll say, the dark side, right? In sports psychology and mental health. And
it's refreshing
to talk a little bit about that journey, but also you said something really important, like the roadblocks, the impediments, that as an athlete, you're not necessarily taught these kinds of things.
Oh my goodness.
How you saw that importance and obviously then made it a way of life for yourself. Mm-hmm. Just love to hear a bit more about that.
So there's so much to share here, as I think that what on the surface is, you know, the Olympic gold medal was a highlight of in my life, right? It was this magical moment, and also it wasn't what I thought it would be. And so I was 18 years old and I had not gone off to college yet. And so, you know, that experience I had, when I think back to the skills that I honed when it came to the mental pillars, I think I was actually doing more than a lot of athletes at that time were. There was, out of the Australian Sports Institute, my coach was downloading and printing these emails when email was like new, right? We were dialing up on the internet. And they were muscle relaxation, which I found this, I'm jumping forward, but maybe at some point we'll talk about the article that came out with that study with swimmers and the contrasting, which I found so interesting and relevant to my life now and why I choose to teach mindfulness in comparing the two. So I did muscle relaxation techniques, a visualization, something that I was doing as an 8-year-old, and I didn't know that was what it was called. You know, I would imagine in my mind. But the emotional awareness and regulation was a piece that was missing, and I lacked language around that. And so when I got to trials and was the fastest American at the time in coming out of the prelims and the semifinals and then going into finals ranked number one in the center lane, and I touched third, which in the sport of swimming, third place is the worst place, except in the freestyle events, which is what I swam, where you get, they take the top four, sometimes six for relays. And I was absolutely, utterly devastated. And also, you know, on top of the world, because I made the Olympics and I made the team, but I did not know how to handle both of those super strong emotions. And so that was a tipping point for me, because it sent me inward. And, you know, without getting into all, you know, all the details of my backstory, I was in an abusive coaching environment when I was a young club athlete, where they talked about our bodies in an inappropriate way. And so the seeds were planted, and it was as though the lack of awareness around my emotions and just the pressure filled moment and this, you know, realizing your childhood dream and it not being the way that you thought it was, all of this was this storm that was brewing inside of me, and I didn't have language. And so I internalized it, and the inner critic grew. So by the time, you know, a month later, I was leading off our Olympic record-breaking relay in Sydney, which was phenomenal. We weren't, on paper, we weren't supposed to win. So being part of that was pure magic. And I was in my own, you know, in my zone, as we talk about, right, in my sports performance, that flow state completely, except when I got out of the water, and then the inner critic would roar. So anytime I was away from the pool. So that spiraled into a place post-Olympics that I think a lot of Olympians and athletes in general struggle with. I think it's a human struggle that's hit a lot of us during this pandemic of who am I? And who am I now with this title? And wrestling in that space. And so I actually found my way to the office of Greg Hardin at University of Michigan, who he's retiring. He retired this week, actually, after 35 years. He was just under the radar there, but he practiced and taught mindfulness, but he didn't call it that. And I actually pulled a book, because this was one of the first that he gave me to read, Thinking Body, Dancing Mind. Have you, are you familiar?
No.
Yeah, so good. So he started to infuse, you know, my homework assignments, this identity work of myself, and then separation from this inner critic, and helped me to heal from what became an eating disorder, a really dark depression, suicidal ideation. He's a social worker by trade, and then we onboarded help for my eating disorder. And so through that 2-year process of healing, he equipped me with these tools to feel free in my skin and to separate, like, I swim, it's something I do, and I am not a swimmer. And we worked really hard on that. And so I was able to have my shoulder surgery and come back, which is you know, the surgery that I needed, it was very rare that you could make a comeback after, because I needed a tightening of my shoulder. And then you had to loosen it just enough to be able to swim. And I was able to finish my career healthy and feeling free. And I actually swam faster than I ever had in my whole life. And I was able to, I transferred for a better environment, and we won a national championship my last year. So for me, that was evidence that greatness and health can coexist. And so as I wrestled a decade later with one of my daughters having open heart surgery, I found myself leaning on the words and work that I did with Greg and the control, the controllables. And his line is like, how are you going to respond? Which is really, for me, it captures the gift of mindfulness and shifting out of victim, that victim mindset. And so I found myself leaning on his words and then having to heal PTSD. Like, I was left that hospital because her heart failed after surgery twice. She was on life support for 7 days. She's thriving now and doing so well. But at that time, was really forced to rumble with this perfectionist armor and this belief that's perpetuated, that is literally what drives my work today, is just dismantle these belief systems that hurt our athletes and as humans, that if you just try hard enough, then you can get exactly what you want. You know, if you just do all the things and you do them right, and you do them the right way, that you'll be able to control the outcome. And that was just thrown in my face. It was like, there's no trying harder to help my daughter's heart heal. So coming off of that and doing that healing work simultaneously allowed me to heal my 18-year-old self and those, that inner turmoil that I was in, because I buried that story. Like, if we had met, you know, 10 years ago, probably wouldn't even have told you that I was an Olympian. You would have had to find that out from somebody else. And I wouldn't have told you the version of the story I'm sharing now. I would have hid some pieces, including the dark stuff. So it was in my healing that I started to share and write. And this question was a burning question. And my therapist today, she's like, I don't know. Like, can you be? We watched, you know, athletes after Rio just make these horrible decisions and fall apart. And she's like, I don't know. Can athletes cultivate greatness and be healthy? Like, this was our burning question. Can you do both? And I reflected back on my work and my time with Greg and, you know, and then through this healing process, your book was 2018. Was it published? Whenever I stumbled on it, I was like in the middle of wrestling with this, going, oh my gosh, like, this is it. Like, we can. And I knew we could, but it was finding and pinpointing what the tools were and how do we do both and how do we cultivate both. So I know that's a windy road to answer your question, but there's the, you know, those pieces, those big life moments for me and the personal experience of what I know now and what I wish I could give that my younger self is what drives me to pay forward. And I was laughing when you said the dark side, because I didn't realize how hard it would be to move the needle of conversations in sport and how much old school thinking is still so gripping. So I have the stamina though, and I can do it. I can do hard things. That's what I tell myself. We have the tools. It's just a matter of what you talk about with the paradox, right? The mental training paradox.
Yeah. I think it's pretty clear you can do hard things.
Yeah.
That is a powerful story that you share.
Yeah. And it's just, I mean, it's just so touching to like hear this journey that you've been on. And I'm so appreciative of like kind of the vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And it's just like such a clear example of how important this work is. Mm-hmm. Right, because like how damaging and how toxic I think some of the culture and some of the mindset can be in sport. I mean, I was thinking about this as you were talking about kind of this balance. But can you achieve greatness and have mental health? And it's like I think there's even a kind of a version of a belief that's like, no, you actually have to sacrifice. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like you need to sacrifice for greatness, and that, like, what you experienced, the eating disorder, the abuse, that was the cost of
that's
your Olympic
just the cost.
Gold medal.
Totally. And that's, I don't know if either of you have seen Athlete A. It just came out about the gymnastics.
I've heard of it. Very much.
I just sobbed because my coaches never touched me, right? It was all verbal. It was so painful because they, you know, to watch my you know, my teammates in Sydney who were there, you know, though they were doing gymnastics. And as I wrote and shared my story, I can't tell you how many people said, oh my gosh, like this was my experience too. Like this was my experience too. And so then I had to walk through the shame of, oh my gosh, how come I held on to this for so long? Like I could have helped other people, but that I, you know, I've worked through that and I'm ready now. But this idea, and they speak to this in Athlete A in this documentary, that like this was just part, like this was just part of what you had to do. Like this was just part of becoming an Olympian, and I reject that. And yeah. That is why I think I face a little bit of resistance. That's okay though.
So I realize this is a large question to ask, but mm-hmm. I'm so curious what your thoughts are about it. When you say it's really hard to move the needle. Mm-hmm. What do you think that's about? What do you think people are clinging to in this system that you're, and I experience it every day, obviously with the consulting we do in MSBE, but also in my private practice work with the clients that I work with in swimming, but across sports, this seems to be such a universal kind of experience that athletes have this.
Yeah. Trade-off. I mean, I think you nail it. I think, oh, so that's so speaking to the trade-off, because I was going to say with the resistance, you highlight it. I mean, I really mean it, and not like they're not secretly paying me to be a spokesperson for MSPE, but I think it was so well done, and you capture, I mean, it's like, yep, here it is. This is the timepiece, or it's that outsider. And the outsider effect to me is fear. For athletes, I think that there's a lack of language. Like we don't, well, I mean, you have, so there's a power structure, right? So I actually, in my work with athletes, and I work with two athletes that sit on world championship teams. One has a world championship title. And we've worked to dismantle this idea that a coach is here and she's here, right? Like dismantling it to say we're co-collaborators. That doesn't necessarily go over well when you have this coaching model that relies on power over, not power with. And so that power structure, and then this, you know, when people believe in you and you love the sport and it allows you to feel good and you don't have a foundation, a strong foundation of identity, your self-worth being built separate from sport, I think the athletes become vulnerable to just doing what the coach says and being sucked into that system. So I think that the resistance, when I come in and start talking about like feedback and how we talk to our athletes and having these conversations, it's like, whoa, like there's a lot of, no, though it's not outspoken, of just like, shut up and do what I say. Like I'm your coach and I know best. And so, I think it takes, it's like I've seen and witnessed conversations on social media, and I just don't know that we make progress there. I think people stay in their fear state, stay in their defenses, and it's just a back and forth. Where I've seen progress are in small group conversations where I talk about, you know, I go first with vulnerability. And then you start to see a softening. And there was an experience that I had last fall where a coach just was sitting there going, oh my gosh, yeah, okay. Like I owe one of my athletes an apology. Like I ride her, and not in a good way, you know, and there was this moment. And then he shifted back to where I think a lot of us go when we're uncomfortable is shame. And so to handle that experience, we have to have a certain level of emotional agility, yeah. Which is again comes back to, okay, well, how do we build that? We build that by practicing mindfulness. So did that answer your question?
Yeah, it really did. And I think what's powerful, I mean, you said several things that are powerful. Well, one of the things that really stood out to me is really, this is a multi-front battle. You're talking mm-hmm. about coaches, you're talking about the adult stakeholders and them not necessarily wanting to relinquish power.
Yeah.
Because of this traditional power structure that exists. But also in talking with the athletes, that it's almost like a threatening, uncomfortable idea to break out of that mm-hmm. that without that, what do we have? Mm-hmm. And you brought up this idea of self-worth. It's hard for me to imagine, or hard for me to recall, excuse me, a client that I've worked with where that hasn't come up.
Yeah.
In some way, mm-hmm. you know, that self-worth is tied so heavily to others' opinions, to outcomes, mm-hmm. and there's this fundamental lack of trust. mm-hmm. in oneself that they can cope without yes. without all of that. And yes. and so I see that as such a big part of, I agree with you, where mindfulness can come in and perhaps teaching somebody how to strengthen those internal yeah. skills to mm-hmm. be able to manage some of that discomfort and find different sources of strength and power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I found myself thinking about kind of control when mm-hmm. you were talking. And it really is. I mean, there's this approach, I think, in sport that it's about control, right? It's like, I'm going to like regiment my training and my sleep and my eating. Like if I can control every possible factor, right, then I can make mm-hmm. sure I get the best performance. And then of course that's being trickled down from the coach because the coach is trying to control the athletes. Of course, mm-hmm. everyone's trying to control their internal experience, which of course is impossible. Mm-hmm. But what we're asking people to do is let go of some of that mm-hmm. control, right? And I think what you were saying about like, I start with vulnerability. Like mm-hmm. what a tremendous example of letting go of control. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like the athletes really respond to it. I've certainly had that experience mm-hmm. you know, in the work mm-hmm. that I do that like, yeah. And it is a scary thing to introduce to someone, but once they get a taste of it and realize, wow, like trying to control everything was actually making it harder for me to cope, right? That was how I was responding to this lack of trust. I was just trying to control, but can I really just trust myself to be able to cope, to be able to be agile, to respond with wisdom, like, mm-hmm. I think it's just an amazing gift to be able to give to an athlete who's kind of come from this control-oriented world.
Mm-hmm. And that, when I think of my best races, they were absolutely about surrender. So it's like, you prepare, and all, and that's where it's like, I think that teaching explicitly, and I teach explicitly this illusion of control, and I have like a little graphic, and I talk about it, and I think that it's easier to, when you fall, to assume that you had some, you know, I think of my daughter's heart surgery. Like it was easier for me at the beginning to blame myself and something that I did, and I made this decision and all these things. And it was to accept that sometimes things happen that are out of our control, or that I'm going to commit my entire life to dedicate to train for the Olympics. And there's actually something that's out of my control that might play a factor into the result and my ability to get there. And so that throws that discomfort. Like, what do you mean I don't have all the control, right? Like, what do you mean I can't control all the things? When it comes down to it though, you know, really getting clear about what you can control, what you can't control. And then when it comes to race time, always, this was what's so fascinating about my athletic journey up to the Olympics, is there are certain things that I had such mastery with. I wouldn't say over, because I think mastery is a continual journey, but this, you know, the ability to, in the ready room ahead of time, have all the fear. Like, what if I was leading off? What if my goggles leak? What if I fall start? And I was able to see that, imagine that, and let those thoughts go by in a cloud. But yet when my inner critic, that Ed voice, was ripping my body apart, I saw no difference in me versus that voice. And then when it came to coming to, you know, standing on the blocks, it was literally let go. Like, now I surrender and I trust my training. I trust that I did my job and I'm going to surrender to this experience. And those were always my best races. And so that's what's so fascinating, is that I think that as athletes, there are certain skills that we hone that transfer, that we aren't being explicit about that transfer. Like, we already know how to do these things. Let's, you know, get bust through what those core beliefs are that are holding us back and be able to shift and move with the skill set that you already have cultivated. Yeah.
I wonder, you know, in our book, we talk a little bit about the difference between acceptance and resignation. Mm-hmm. And I find that one of the synonymous conversations I have quite often is about this idea of surrender and vulnerability mm-hmm. as well, and how those are really tough words for athletes and coaches to hear. Mm-hmm. And when I hear you talk about it, because I know you've studied this and you've lived mm-hmm. this, and that it has a slightly different ring to it. And maybe you mm-hmm. could just sort of articulate that a little bit for our listeners, is when you talk about surrender, when you talk about vulnerability, you're not talking about giving up.
Mm-hmm. No.
You're not talking about, mm-hmm. oh, well, you know, there's nothing I can do here. I'm just going to sort of throw in the towel. And, or even perhaps, you know, I don't care, which is another yeah. way that this gets misunderstood. You know, I'm just, yeah. whatever, I don't care about this anymore. So how can you define these ideas of surrender vulnerability as you're describing them? Or how do you for your clients or the people you work with?
So the backstory to this, when I was dealing with trauma, there's lots of, big T, little T trauma. We could talk about that and the experience that, so many of us have, but dealing with the trauma of my daughter and that healing from that journey, like that was something that I hadn't experienced before with the dissociation and the intense rage and all of that. So that for me, once I started to identify my triggers, it was like, okay, I wasn't saying this consciously, but I was like going to figure out a way to be the best at this. And I'm going to know all my triggers. And so when I would get caught off guard, I'd get really angry. And so my therapist, that anger I know now, and I say this all the time, and I make, my little quotes and share them on social media, that we cannot rise if we're on the ground beating ourselves up. And so in that moment that I would know that I was triggered, one of my signs is that I lose taste in my mouth. I can't taste anything. So I'm eating super strong gum, and I'm like, okay, that makes sense now why I'm in this, feeling all the things that I'm feeling internally. And then I would get stuck there, so mad at myself for getting there and being there. And it would just keep me stuck, and it would just spiral. And so she sent me to Kristen Neff's website. And for me, I'm laughing because I took her quiz, I was pretty pissed off, and I'm like, what is this Kristen Neff lady? And I took her quiz, and I was like proud of how I was answering those questions in this moment. So this was early into my healing, and I was like, I don't even know if I made it on her scale. My score was so low. And there was that inner critic part of me that was like, that the perfectionist pulls were like, yeah, see, like I'm so tough on myself. And so it took seeing and reading her research, because I also have like this science brain, this science, that was my undergrad, so I was in the space of cognitive dissonance. Yeah. I'm like, whoa. So what do you mean my inner critic's not my edge? What do you mean this voice isn't serving me? And so I think it was rumbling. And so I take that work and I give, giving her all the credit for this and sharing the story. And I say these things explicitly to athletes, like, if you take your foot off the gas, you will not implode. Right. Rest is important. Rest is built into tapers. So that's an example of what I mean when I say, like, part of this is accepted as it's going to help us, but rest, if you're struggling, having a hard mental health day or asking for help, coaches give us help every day. So we receive their help, but why aren't we willing to receive this coach's help, who's a mental health professional? Yeah. And so I use that language and speak directly to the beliefs that I held on to and how I rumbled with them and rewrote them. And they're based now. There's evidence, there's data to support the fact that actually when you beat yourself up because of what's happening in the present moment, all you're doing is staying stuck in the present moment instead of tapping into your agency and choosing to respond to it, right? But I think to do that, there's a space between where we have to sit with the discomfort of whatever we're feeling. And that's what people, I think, knocking around with that.
Oh, yeah. And for everyone out there, so Kristen Neff is a researcher who specializes in self-compassion, which is, I 100% agree, I think is hugely important for athletes, and they are so, so resistant to it.
Mm-hmm. So can I share when I started? I was like, my first summit I'm presenting and I'm talking all about self-compassion. I hadn't found my way to your work yet. And as soon as I read it, I was like, this is totally skillful. There's a reason that you're not using the word self-compassion, but you're describing the tenets of it, the three tenets of it. And so it was the group received it, though. It was like trying to book another one, after that is, I actually had a leader of a coach organization say, I can't fill a room with that. We can't talk about that. I can't fill a room. The coaches won't come. And yet it is actually the very thing, because it incorporates mindfulness, that I believe is necessary to rise. And in sport and in life, we will be thrown curveballs. And so instead of trying to outrun them, achieve our way out of them, trying to run from the heart or numb it, if we turn toward it and we build the tools and learn how to cope, like you mentioned, like know what's in my, what is explicitly, what do I want to move toward when I'm in this state? How do I want to respond? Like that's the key. Like that's the sauce right there for that greatness and health to code with.
Yeah. But right, I think like athletes need to be given that knowledge and the permission to use it, right? Because they live and they exist in these environments where coaches won't show up for that, where they will explicitly tell athletes not to think that way. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, it actually makes me remember this experience I had in college where this wasn't exactly about self-compassion, but it was about, like, rest. I remember I was a rower in college. It was a D3 school, and actually the men's team wasn't a varsity sport. We were a club sport, and so we didn't have access to all of the stuff that the varsity sports had. And then my sophomore year, they changed some things around, and so we could start seeing the trainers. Mm. And we had this team meeting with the head athletic trainer, who's this, like, really amazing, very knowledgeable guy. And he was like, all right, tell me about your training schedule for the week. And we laid out to him all the training that we did. And the first thing he was like, that's way too much. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time as an athlete, I'd been rowing for 6 years, where a coach had ever told me, like, that's mm-hmm. too much. You're going mm-hmm. too hard. You need to rest. You need to back off. And mm-hmm. it was like, how had I never heard that in 6 years? Right. Mm-hmm. Like, it's crazy.
And as you say it, to be honest, there's the part of me, there's that part, those old perfectionist pathways that don't go away. It's why I joke I'm a recovering perfectionist, because I do, first, I think it's addictive for real and dangerous. And also, I have to consciously put it down. As you talk, there's that part that gets revved up, like, there's no such thing as hard. You know, right. I can't be overdoing it, right? So I have to notice. That's why mindfulness has been such a gift for me, because I'm able to notice that, and it doesn't get in the driver's seat. So I just, there it is. And that's, yeah. I think, yeah. So how did you, too much work. I think one thing that when you were saying that comes up as resistance from coaches, and actually at this conversation, she's one of the leaders in swimming. She's looked up to as a mentor and has had a lot of amazing athletes, trained a lot of amazing athletes. And what she gets heat for, because she honors the whole human first. And so in doing that, these club coaches work so hard to get their athletes to these amazing Division I programs. And then by honoring the whole self, when you allow space for tapping into what is my intention, what's driving me, like what you start to get into that conversation and bring awareness to their experiences. There are some athletes that are doing it because they're doing it out of fear, not because they love it. And that they then decide to walk from the sport. And so that is, then we walk that down and say, okay, so then what? Like, do you want an athlete who's purely performing out of fear and miserable, or do you want an athlete to walk from the sport and find something that they love because you care about them as a human? And honestly, most coaches will say the latter, but they're caught in that they don't want to have to deal with that experience of losing one of their best athletes.
Well, there's such a tension here that in different ways, I think you're articulating between, people maybe having good intentions or having good goals of trying to maximize performance or trying to get the most out of their athletes. But being really stuck in a certain way of doing things, and it's hard to really let in that, oh wait, this doesn't work the way we intend it to. Mm. You just mentioned this idea of fear. Certainly Tim and I talk about this all the time. Mm-hmm. I see it in my work all the time, how common it is that athletes, that coaches use fear as a primary source of motivation. Mm-hmm. And are so attached to that. And even if they see the sort of toxic underpinnings of that, it's really hard to let that go. So mm-hmm. they may be taking the time, the money to go to a consultant, to go to a psychologist, to get help, to change, to improve. But telling them, okay, well, we kind of have to look at this system that's mm-hmm. maybe making this harder for you. That's a hard thing to let go of.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's where you anchor into. So I always start with values and how, and that conversation, like, that's not common either, right? How do you want to live your life? Like, because what I know and what I share is that when you get to the top of that podium, like, that podium moment didn't protect me from pain. And I think that a lot of athletes, like, willing to sacrifice and live in the space of fear, because if I just get there, then I won't feel pain. And that doesn't happen, no matter what level of money you make, no matter, like, nothing, because we're human. And so when you can just pull, help them walk to that space, it's like, okay, so you can't run from it. And no level you achieve is going to fill the void. And I know, I was teammates with Michael. I don't know where he was at in 2000. It was one of his first. But then, he talks openly about his challenges with mental health. And it's like, is it worth it, right? Is it not worth it. It's not the right word. That's not what I mean to ask. It's more along, like, is it getting, it's evidence that getting there isn't going to protect us from being human. And that no matter who you are or what you achieve, that we as humans are going to feel these emotions. And so then you have to ask yourself, okay, how do I want to show up along the way? And so that athlete, like, is it working for them? I guess that's the question. Like, is it working for them? And at what cost? That's another question I ask. At what cost?
Yeah. And that's such a big part of what you're saying is, I like your description. You're a recovering perfectionist, that this mm-hmm. doesn't ever fully go away. And mm-hmm. I think that fear model, that motivational system is actually based around trying to eliminate fear, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to eliminate these things that you've said in a number of ways today, Samantha, is part of the experience of being an athlete. There's gonna be mm-hmm. those feelings. There's gonna mm-hmm. be that discomfort. And yeah. kind of brings me back to when we were talking about surrender and vulnerability, that mm-hmm. the goal here is not to eliminate that discomfort. The idea is to be able to coexist with it, to in some ways be able to embrace it and thrive in their presence.
Mm-hmm. And, exactly. and so, to harness the power. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And mm-hmm. and that's a pretty big source of power when people can tap into it. But again, this maybe takes us all the way back to what we started with today. It's hard to move that needle. Mm-hmm. That's a hard thing for, I think, a lot of folks, understandably so. I totally mm-hmm. get it. It's hard to fully wrap our brains around how that can work because it's so foundational to the human experience. We want to maximize pleasure, minimize pain, and to say, well, part of this, when you're swimming in the Olympics, there's going to be pain. Mm-hmm. There's going to be discomfort.
So this is, and I don't know where we are on time, but that you're hitting on what I want to explore more deeply, which is what I call the pain paradox in sport, which is this, I will push through, I slammed through torn tendons in Sydney. So I needed shoulder surgery and I was like too close to make the call. So I did everything I could to just manage it. And then post, that was part of that darkness. So the ability to push through pain physically is like revered. Right? It's just what we do in sport. But when it comes to that emotional pain, we just want out. Like, it's like, no, thank you. And so if we can become, and I don't advocate for pushing through physical pain when you need surgery. That's another day's conversation, getting into that space. But this idea of when we're feeling these emotions, and I think what mindfulness has helped me to do is just release the labels, like release the judgment of what I'm experiencing. And part of the meditation today is that coming into our bodies with curiosity of what exactly what the physical sensations we're experiencing are versus labeling these things as good and bad and positive or negative. It's powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as you alluded to, we are unfortunately out of time, but we really, really appreciate you joining us and your willingness to share your story and to talk about the work that you're doing now, which is so important. And if you want to take a moment, if you want to let our listeners know how they can reach out to you, it's hard to imagine that anyone who'd listen to this podcast that what you were talking about would not resonate or appeal in some ways. So I imagine people might have questions or might want to pick your brain. So how can people reach out to you if they want to?
Yeah, so Samantha@SamanthaLivingstone.com is my email, and I welcome emails and as well as my website. And then the control the controllables, I've taken what Greg taught me and turned it into a deep dive. So it's a workbook that you can download and print. So if you go to SamanthaLivingstone.com and then /control, I always get them confused. So it's forward tilting, which tilts to the right. And that they can download and that goes right to your email. So that's just an awesome deep dive that you can print out. And that's the thing, is like making an appointment with yourself, setting alarms on your phone to take a deep breath, to print this material and then sit with it, and giving ourselves that permission when that, that sense of urgency and I have to do all these things comes flooding into the body is to do that. And then one more thing I just want to share because of my mental health hat, and I know both of you are in the field. the work I do serves as a bridge, and I believe so strongly in shifting our system in the athletic arena to more proactive, protective spaces. And so as mental health first aid is a program from the National Council of Behavioral Health, and it, you know, mindfulness is evidence-based. It's an evidence-based protective factor. And so that is why when I say the work I do provides pillars of support to elevate mental health and improve performance, it's because you can actually do both. And you can do both by doing what you've laid out, right, in this, in your book, and in this, in infusing mindfulness practices into the program. So I think that I'm confident that we're going to make progress. I mean, I work with amazing coaches who are risk takers, right? And the fact that they're allowing this work to come in and they're doing it themselves. And so I think that we can't deny the crisis, the mental health crisis. And so that, so why not do both at one time, right? Yeah. Why not, teach this tool?
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you for letting me share that.
Yeah. No, thank you. I mean, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for the work you do. It's just amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah, it truly is. And thank you to everyone who listened to this episode. If you would like to connect with us, you can visit our website, our MSP Institute website at www.mindfulsportperformance.org. You can also connect with us on our Facebook page, our MSPE Facebook page. And you can follow me, Dr. Keith Kaufman, on Twitter, and my handle is @mindfulsportdoc. And we just want to take one final moment and again thank our producer, Taylor Brown from the University of Texas at Austin, and our colleague, Dr. Carol Glass, for all of her support. So thank you again, Samantha. Thank you to everyone who listened, and we'll see you soon.
Yeah, thanks, everyone. See you next time.
Hi, this is Taylor Brown, the producer of the Mindful Sport Performance Podcast. We hope you enjoyed the first season with Tim and Keith. We'll be back for season 2 in September. Subscribe now so you don't miss it.